At least for open a public hearing. We open the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use, and welcome everybody. Today's April 25th, and let me open a public hearing on Senate Bill 90 and ask our esteemed colleague, Senator Brian Boquist, to join us at the seating area. What's the dais? Is this the dais? Witness stand. The witness stand. You know, we have the right to put people under oath, I believe, as committee, but... And we're worried about...
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian Boquist, I don't think the House has ever done it. I think the only legislator ever to put people under oath is yours truly. But I'd be happy to give you the first opportunity. I put the governor and the governor's staff under oath. Uncover Oregon, remember?
That's fantastic.
And I think it's fair to do it.
If you'll feel good about yourself and pass the bill, I'll take the oath.
We're worried about olive oil, you know, shenanigans that we may have to deputize everybody here. All right, tell us what we need to know.
Okay, Mr. Chair, for the record, again, Brian Boquist, Senate District 12. My district starts in the edge of Washington County and sweeps down the western side of the Willamette Valley with six voters in Lane County. They're not Republicans. I did poll them years ago. Secretary of State says they doesn't exist. They vote for me, so I keep them in my county. But I would not have known I had an olive oil plantation, a whopping 5 acres in my district, had not the Lawrences brought forward this issue. Years and years ago, when we did farm to market stuff, everybody did the normal things. You can do hazelnuts and you can do walnuts. Walnuts myself, but nobody thought about olive oil, olive trees, and farm to market for that. Thinking, even though they're not the only olive producer, there are other olive producers in the state of Oregon, the Lawrences decided they should comply with the law. Obviously not, you know, they're from the honest part of my district. What transpired is they went to the Department of Agriculture and said, we're doing olives, when I go farm to market, how do we do this? And the Department of Agriculture tried to reach out and help them and suddenly found out olives aren't in the law anyplace. So it was neither for it or against it. And so the Department of Agriculture advised them to come see their, as they always do when there's a problem, come see your legislator. And so we are here trying to put the consignment of olive oil from their olive plantation, all 5 acres and 400 and some trees, into the law so that they can do direct farm to market of olive oils. And you, of course, they will give you this, the whole synopsis. You can't get a case, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair. Sorry, that's bribery. But samples are legal, and they're going to talk a little bit about that. I was asked to try and snitch another bottle for Senator Hass and take it back for my excuse for not being on revenue voting for a tax increase. But with that, I'll let the Lawrences, you know, kind of give their presentation, and then we'll answer questions after that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, colleagues.
Welcome.
You didn't see this. Members of the committee, my name is David Lawrence. I'm co-owner of a small olive tree farm near Amity, Oregon, co-requester of SB 390, and the actual farmer and olive mill operator. I'm requesting your support for the advancement of Senate Bill 390. I believe this bill to be a simple fix or correction of the current farm direct market law. First, I note SB 390 had a Senate vote of 29-0. I'd like to give special thanks to Senator Boquist. Without his help, we would not be here today. I am also responsible for the in-kind campaign contribution you see in front of you today. The Amphisa cultivar from which that olive oil is made is from Greece. If you've had any reason to consult the Oracle in Delphi, you'll have seen a lot of these trees. We also put some analytical results into the OLIS system that show it is indeed a USDA extra virgin olive oil, because there is a lot of controversy about people trying to scam the system. It is also taste tested as a robust Tukoff extra virgin olive oil. So this is a little bit more sophisticated than what we gave the Senate, figuring you all are sophisticated people who would appreciate such an offering. If you don't choose to accept it, your senior assistant has agreed to accept them after the meeting and properly dispose of them.
Looking for some bread.
Full disclosure, this is a estate, single varietal, extra virgin olive oil. It's totally worthless because we three times reached out to the Oregon Department of Agriculture and were told three times in a row we couldn't sell it. We made it under the assumption we could sell it under the Farm Direct Law, and they said three times no, and that the only remedy was to have the law changed. So here we are. That's about it for me. Thanks for your time and consideration. in advancing Senate Bill 390. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions? Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's not in law, maybe Senator Boquist, maybe a question for you. It's not in law because there have never been olive oil trees in Oregon before, is that?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, actually, I was wrong in the Senate committee. I was wrong. I want to admit that, okay? Please, Madam Vice Chair, don't have a heart attack on that. Right? I was wrong, and I thought, no, that's true. But apparently there is at least one other grower of olive trees down on the southern Oregon coast. There's one other grower. Other than that, there's been never been any commercial olive oil. There is actually a producer who markets, quote, olive oil from Oregon, but they truck in all of their olives from out of state. And so literally, this has never came up with the Department of Agriculture, because I would assume somebody in their backyard, some master gardener, grew some olive trees or something. But there's never been any commercial production that anybody can find, which is why the Department of Agriculture didn't have one way or the other they could do it.
Fascinating.
Williams, and then we'll come to.
Oh, we can go to Vice Chair.
Vice Chair McLean.
Good heavens! So, my understanding is that this is perfectly fine with the Department of Ag, and all we have to do is just change the words in the law.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, that's actually absolutely correct. In fact, we work with the Department of Agriculture to do this one little quirk. And if you look, it's really simple. It just adds it in there.
Okay.
And yes, I mean, they didn't come to our hearing on the Senate side either. But then we're senators. I can understand why they wouldn't come to us. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Williams.
There's winery that sells olives that they grow on their property, and they also have honey somewhere in the Willamette. Were they doing something illegal?
The list already.
Yeah, and obviously wine is on the list, but they're also selling olive oil from olives that they grow on their own property.
Chairman Clem, may I answer that question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Chairman Clem and members of the committee, Representative Williams, there is one licensed olive oil miller in Oregon. He bought a machine on sort of the betting on the come. So there are small holdings of olive oil that go to him to have made, but there's only three people that make olive oil from Oregon-grown olives. The rest are importing the olives from California and having him mill for them.
I see.
Our lot sizes, we specialize. We have about 80 different varietals. We started in 2006 planting trees. Some of our trees are now a dozen years old. We yield thousands of pounds, of which I submitted to OLIS a picture of some rotting olives we couldn't even have any use for because we can't sell the stuff. But we're so small and our lot sizes are so small, and with 80 different varieties, we only have about 5 trees of each variety. So we don't have enough to meet minimum commercial lot sizes of that miller, or to take him down to California and have him milled.
Thank you. That was clarity I needed.
And Mr. Chair, I would just follow up, not answering the representative's questions, considering the situation. But honey is allowed in the law. You'll see it on line 5 of the second page. And whoever was selling olive oil or farm to market was operating illegally. And we're here to correct that and save them.
Vice Chair,
I'm going to vote anyway. I can't represent it.
Williams, you said olives, not olive oil. Right?
They were selling olive oil, and I know honey's already in the law, but they just have a lot of sort of farm to market stuff that they're selling, and I just trying to figure out if I was misinterpreting what was going on here.
Okay, I thought you had said olives, and I was going to say that's covered. I see olives are in there, but they were selling olive oil.
Olive oil as well.
Okay.
And at the risk of sounding really uninformed, I'm pretty sure this was actually my bill in the beginning 10 years ago that created the Farm Direct Law. And we had a work group that essentially came up with what products people were talking about that they wanted to sell and which ones could be safely done without having to go through the full licensing regime. And so you could actually do olive oil, obviously, like at a grocery store if you go and get, you know, a license to do it. This is all about who can sell directly without having commercial kitchens and getting licenses. And We just, it didn't come up at the time. And, but everything that came up, we debated, and some things we said, no, that's probably too low of pH or too high of pH. I can't remember which. So we're not gonna do that. And just no one brought up olive oil, so it never got on the list. And so now it'll go on the list. And probably at some point we should like delegate to ODA the ability to add more to the list without having to come back here every time, because like we don't need to come back here every time for this stuff. Because we ask ODA, honestly, we ask ODA food safety, I don't know, what do you think? Is it okay or not? And if they say, yeah, it's fine, they should just probably add it at that point. So maybe we can either work on an amendment. If you don't want your bill amended, we can do it next session. We can add in and whatever else ODA believes is okay.
Sure. My preference would be you just take your fine bill from the two sessions ago and put olive oil to it, because I did ask that question to them, and the sudden question was, well, testing and liability, and the department wasn't keen on your idea, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, we'll just get this baby moving.
One more.
Vice Chair Post.
There's one more for Senator Boquist and perhaps Lawrence's. Thank you. I don't want to slow anything down or anything, but I just, have you thought about whether we put the 91 days from sign to die on here just to move things along a little faster? Or?
Are you asking for
an emergency clause?
Oh, just set the effective date.
91 days from sign to die.
Would you like this to go into effect as soon as possible?
Chairman Clem, the harvest season starts in November, so if it would make it legal to sell this existing olive oil, which I don't think it's post-datable, then it won't do us any good until November when the harvest comes.
Going into effect January?
January 1st.
Yeah, would you like to do it before January?
If it makes that November olive oil legal, yes.
I would be glad. So you've got a concurrence vote on olive oil.
Mr. Chair, if it would indulge the committee, I can have a amendment done.
Sure. Laura can help get it processed.
Chairman Clem, if it's going to box things up, it isn't that...
It won't. It'll.
We're happy to give it away to people like you. We'd much rather sell it, but we're happy to give it away.
Watch you like a hawk.
It'll add like 2 days to the bill passing, and then you can sell it in what? Yeah, whatever. I can't even do the math. April, May,
soon,
May, June, July. Sometime in September, you could sell it instead of January.
I want to say something semi funny.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, it's already funny.
The only reason that we don't want to do this is because it gives him 2 days more to think of another amendment that he might want to put in. But he is telling you he's going to be a purist and that we're just going for this one amendment that the author suggested would be fine.
No Frank and clams. It's a tight relating clause relating to the sale of olive oil.
Okay, good.
So like, I don't know what else I can get in there. But.
Don't let him look anymore at this.
Chairman, I might point out, I think the Department of Agriculture is going to be really resistant because there's this tension between you and them about who makes laws, and if they modify laws that under the administrative orders, if they contradict or overrule the law, and the law expressly says you cannot do anything but what's on this list, and their attitude was, we don't make laws, sorry, go talk to the legislature.
If they have an administrative rule right now that kind of mirrors this and we change it, they'll update their administrative rule to match it.
Chairman Clem, I point out you did an excellent job when you wrote the original bill. There's already such a clause that allows them to make such changes. They just refuse to even acknowledge it's in there. But legislative council, I was told, says that we didn't even have to come to you, that we could go directly to
products identified by the department by rule. So actually the other thing I talked about is already in there. They could already add something by rule.
Yeah.
But they just apparently didn't feel comfortable doing that.
Correct. That's my understanding.
I can assure you if we put olive oil in and put a clause on it, they're not going to block us. Yeah, that's okay. We had a couple members of their budget committee sitting here too. They'd have larger problems if they didn't want to follow legislative direction in this case, I think.
Okay, sure. Just for clarification, for us lowly senators, do you want to amend it or not?
I think we should set the effective date 91 days so we can have the November oil ready to go.
On that.
Okay, and Laura can just do it if you want and show you a copy, but
See a copy. I'm perfectly fine if it turns into, what did you two call this, Mr. Vice Chair, the Clementine bill?
No, that's something, you don't want that.
If it turns out to be that, I'm sure the two vice chairs will.
I will let you know.
Okay, thank you.
A Frankenclim related to olive oil.
Now, suddenly Washington County's boundaries will be getting changed in the olive oil bill if we're not careful. So
and Damascus will be.
Yeah, Damascus will be brought back to life. And then somebody will be withdrawn from a district in Kaiser Fire.
Are we done?
We're done.
Thank you.
We're definitely done. Thank you for coming off down to your government. And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390. That's what we haven't met in a while. We just, a little while. Let me open a Senate bill, public hearing on Senate Bill 1012, and ask Mr. Dave Honeycutt.
Is this not the one that needed it?
I don't think it's needed. Okay. I thought for a while we didn't even need this, but I forgot to pull it off the agenda. So you tell us whether we still need this.
We still need this.
Oh, okay. Okay. There's a House bill that's sitting over there that we're going to maybe do something with.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Actually, speaking of which, you're usually the one who talks me into the various omnibus Franken bills. It's not me, even.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Chair. Chair Clem, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Property Owners Association here in support of Senate Bill 1012, which came out of the Senate Business and General Government Committee on a 4-0 vote and off the Senate floor on a 21-6 vote, which for a bill that deals with marijuana is a pretty good vote count. What I normally don't talk about the summaries to the bills, but I would ask you to the committee to take a look at the summary on this. What the summary for Senate Bill 1012 says is that it clarifies the existing law, and I think that's important here because I don't believe what we're doing. I believe what we're doing is what the existing law is, but there's some ambiguity in 475B074, and that ambiguity has led to some confusion both on the part of the property owners and on the part of OLCC. And so what we're trying to do with this bill is nail that down. In 2016, the legislature passed Senate Bill 1598, which for that session was the BMB, the big marijuana bill for that session. It had a whole variety of issues that were dealt with related to marijuana, but the one provision that applied here was Section 2 of that bill. And the idea behind, and that became 475B074, and the idea behind that section was to give people who held licenses, grow licenses for medical marijuana, to convert that medical license over to a recreational license without having to obtain a land use compatibility statement from the local government if they were small growers, 1,250 square feet or less of a canopy on an indoor grow, or 5,000 square feet of canopy or less on an outdoor grow. So we're talking about the micro tier growers. If they had their medical, and there were two criteria that they needed to satisfy in order to not have to obtain a LUCS, land use compatibility statement, which we refer to by its acronym, a LUCS from the local government. And those criteria were that they had their registration for their medical marijuana grow registration for that site on or before January 1 of 2015. And they also had their active registration for their medical marijuana grow site on the date that they submitted their application to convert that from medical over to the recreational site. So those were the two criteria in the statute. You had it before that property before January 1, 2015, and you had it on the day you submitted your application for your recreational to convert over to the recreational site. And the intent of the legislature of that particular piece of that bill was to recognize that these smaller medical folks had already established essentially a grow site on that particular property. And so there would be no need for them to go through the local land use compatibility statement process just to switch essentially from growing for medical purposes to growing for recreational purposes. We had, unfortunately, a gentleman by the name of Randy Bessens, and you can see his letter on OLIS, his testimony letter on OLIS. Mr. Bessens had his medical permit, and he acquired it in 2007 when he lived in Ashland. He moved to Deschutes County in 2010, I believe, or 2011, and he got that license for his property in Deschutes County in 2012. He had it on January 1 of 2015. And in 2017, he applied to convert from the medical side to the recreational side, and he had it at that time as well. He did let his license lapse for that particular Deschutes County property between May and November of 2015. He had a six-month period where he had some health issues, and his license had lapsed for a six-month period between May and November of 2015. He submitted his application to OLCC to move forward with the recreational side. Everything was going fine. It looked like he was going to be approved. He spent $200,000. He borrowed money. He spent $200,000 to upgrade his facility to OLCC standards. He got his transfer permit from the OHA to transfer his medical stock essentially into recreational stock. And the day before OLCC was going to come out and inspect the site and make sure that he complied with all OLCC requirements, he got a call from OLCC saying, "We believe this statute not only requires that you show that you had your license on January, or your medical license on January 1, 2015, and on the day you submitted your application, but that you also had to hold it continuously during that time. And because you let your license lapse, the statute doesn't apply to you." I said, "I don't think that's what the statute said," but I approached Representative Helm and Senator Przanski and said, because they were on the committee that passed Senate Bill 1598 in 2016, and I said, "Is that your read of the statute?" And Representative Helm can speak for himself, but that wasn't what Senator Przanski thought that the bill did either. And so what Senate Bill 1012 does is just make it clear that in order to qualify to not have to obtain a LOX, you just have to hold your permit. You had to hold your medical permit on January 1, 2015, and on the day you submit for your recreational license to convert over. So that's all the bill does. There was no opposition to the bill on the Senate side. I don't think there's any opposition today. And so I would ask the committee to look at this with approval and move it along.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One small comment, Dave. You know where I'm going, don't
I
you?
Do. I do. Mr. Chair, Representative Post, if your question is why is there an emergency clause on this bill, the reason why there's an emergency clause on this bill, when OLCC said that Mr. Bessens did not qualify because of their interpretation of the statute, he had to appeal that interpretation. So it's the appeal is sitting there on hold because Mr. Bessens is out of money. And so I said, get your appeal in and put it on hold. If we can get a bill through that obviates the need for you to go further on your appeal, then that would be great. And so the reason for the emergency clause is so that so that he doesn't have to do anything more to move forward with his appeal.
Okay. Well, it wasn't so much I wasn't dying on that hill necessarily, but I haven't voted yes on a marijuana bill in my entire time in this legislature. So, you know, it would have made my pain a little less. But I'll be okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I'll get another chance to do this, but I agree completely with what Mr. Honeycutt just said. And that's on the permanent record now. All joking aside, I'm completely serious. I've been working with Mr. Honeycutt all during the interim and through the session. This is one of those extraordinarily frustrating circumstances in which not only were Senator Przanski and I on the committee that passed this legislation, we drafted this section ourselves with legislative counsel specifically to do exactly the job that Mr. Honeycutt is describing. We had a group of folks that we specifically wanted to grandfather so that they would be incented to move from the medical program into the highly regulated adult program where their products could be tracked and they would be subject to all the other safeguards of the adult use recreation system. And folks that were willing to do that, we said, fine, you don't need to jump through the additional hoops of doing so. This Department of Justice opinion is contrary to the very words that Senator Przanski and I drafted as lawyers. We knew what we were doing. And it has been a struggle to get that intent abided by. So much so that we're here. This bill gets us back to the intent that was the original, and I would entreat you to please do what Mr. Honeycutt is asking and have us pass this bill out of the committee and get the statute straight again and not catch people like Mr. Bissens, who has been above board, honest, working in with a great deal and high level of patience with the very agency that is thwarting him to get what he deserves.
I support it.
Okay. Anybody else questions?
No? Nobody else on our list? Okay. Let me close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1012. And let me open a public hearing on, oh, this is going to be great, Senate Bill 92. And ask the Doyle family to join us at the witness stand. So great. When's Father's Day?
Later.
Are we doing anything special?
Commemorating this is in picture in a frame, hold on, probably.
This is so great. Welcome, Doyles. Who would like to start?
Well, I will, Representative Clem, I want to thank you for letting us be here. But before I get into that, just to continue with the humor, do you know today's National Take Your Daughter to Work Day?
Oh, my Lord. That is so...
Go to work with your daughter day.
Isn't that funny?
It is fantastic. And, Mr. Mayor, for the record, you are...
You just state your name.
Mayor Denny Doyle, City of Beaverton, Oregon.
Thank you. Can't think when I'm lying. I'm sorry.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Post, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denny Doyle, Mayor of Beaverton. On behalf of the city, I would like to express our strong support for Senate Bill 92, particularly the extension of the phasing-in period for property tax rates to up to 20 years rather than the current option of up to 10 years. This expands the tool Oregon cities use at their discretion to ease the transition of property owners who might experience an increase in their property tax as a result of joining a city with a higher level of urban services. Providing efficient public services is one of the utmost importance to cities across Oregon. A 20-year maximum phase-in provides cities an enhanced and more flexible tool to make a transition doable for property owners, many of whom might need or desire the level of services a city can provide. And cities with irregular boundaries can have more comfortable conversations with unincorporated communities that may be interested in voluntarily coming into a city, by creating a longer time frame to transition from a lower unincorporated county tax rate to a higher city tax rate. In addition, once the property owner sells the property tax ramp up ends, and the new owners will pay the normal city property tax rate, limiting the fiscal impact on cities and ensuring fairness for city taxpayers. I strongly urge your support for Senate Bill 92, and I thank you for the opportunity to comment, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle, daughter of Mayor Denny Doyle, as we have established, I'm here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Annexation impacts more than just the city of Beaverton, so I would like to go over the third and final piece of what this bill does. Essentially, as our cities grow, occasionally we started them close enough to one another that they're going to grow into one another. And as cities are trying to establish what the incorporated or the boundaries around an island are, sometimes one of those boundaries is another city. And that was not recognized when we said what had to be the boundary around the island. So this bill just adds that as an additional factor that can be considered so that as, for example, the city of Beaverton abuts a number of cities, but we'll use Tigard because it's the clearest, it's really close to my house, so it's easier for me to remember. The city of Beaverton is to the north. There is a road that will remain in county right-of-way, and then on the other side of it is another incorporated city, the city of Tigard. If there is an island where the fourth edge is the city of Tigard, this would allow us to count that as an island and use the island annexation methodology to bring that chunk of the unincorporated area into the city using that methodology. We think this is a simple fix for a limited number of properties, but there's no other way for us to create that fourth wall without allowing for using the incorporated boundaries of the other city. So it couldn't be unincorporated on one side, and that's Beaverton's island, and unincorporated on the other side, that's Tigard's island. It has to be the city of Tigard or whomever it would be. Not a lot of our cities run into each other, but where they do, they need a clear path forward so that we don't leave these people in limbo and thus violating the intention and spirit of the land use laws of how we urbanize in a regulated fashion. And with that, I am happy to answer any questions. After I state, I would also like to congratulate the mayor and his wife on their 42 years of marriage celebrated yesterday.
Oh. Going so well. Any questions? Vice Chair McLean.
I don't have any questions. I just, this is, in my mind, a necessary cleanup for these types of circumstances so you don't have property owners that really are left in kind of a limbo situation of not knowing where they are with the cities around them. And then also it does really help with the island annexations. It's annexation, but I plan on voting yes if we can get a work session. So it sounds like the right thing to do, both for the cities and for the property owners.
Representative Helm, what about you?
Mr. Mayor, very happy to have you here, my mayor. And I think I agree that we should take the city's lead. The city of Beaverton, not under this mayor's tenure, but in the past, has had a rocky road with annexations. Mm-hmm. And I am glad to see that your suggestion is one that is much more measured and forward-looking. I think it's good policy for us. And we ought to have the two of you here more often.
Are you sure you don't see enough of me?
Well, I kind of like the pairing.
Any further questions, comments? Okay, let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 92. Thank you. And, is Representative Drazen? Oh, there she is. Okay, open informational meeting and ask Representative Drazen to join us. And you're going to be bringing Gerald Murphy with you? Okay, great.
Vice Chairs McLean and Post and members of the committee, thank you for accepting my request to hold an informational meeting on channel migration zones, also known as CMZs. In addition to my role now serving in the legislature prior to that and continuing from there, I serve on the Clackamas County Planning Commission. And at that time, we were addressing flood issues, and we were updating our comprehensive plan to allow people to continue to be eligible for flood insurance. Mm-hmm. And this issue was brought forward at that time by my colleague on the Planning Commission, Gerald Murphy, who you will hear from next. County staff seeking guidance from the Planning Commission at that time presented information on the impacts of channel migration along the Upper Sandy, where 1,400 residents are located. These issues are challenging to address for local jurisdictions, since there is no existing state guidance on this subject, though there is in Washington and in other states. Local jurisdictions at this time are just working under the umbrella of Goal 7. The county is currently working with several state agencies through an Oregon Solutions process, and I look forward to hearing and seeing the results of that work. But for this time, in the meantime, my hope is to provide this opportunity and this forum to allow folks to discuss this known hazard at a state level. So I really appreciate you, Chair Clem, for agreeing to hold this informational hearing, and now I'd like to hand it off to the experts.
Welcome.
You're talking about
me. Well.
Okay. Chairman Rep. Brian Clem, Vice Chair Representative Susan McLean, Vice Chair Representative Bill Post, and committee, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Gerald Murphy. I live in Timberline Rim Subdivision in Rhododendron, just east of Brightwood on the Upper Sandy River. I lived in my neighborhood for 32 years. The neighborhood consists of 500 buildable lots. Currently, there's 450 developed. The neighborhood was built on the north and south sides of the Sandy River. The homeowners membership owns the Timberline Rim Water Company that supplies the neighborhood with at least 500 other neighborhoods. Clackamas County owns the sewer system, both the water and sewer crossing, cross under the river to service members on both sides. Our neighborhood was approved as a subdivision in 1968, 4 years after the 1964 flood, which is considered a 500-year flood. In 1965, the Army Corps of Engineers engineered the river. Dozers created a river channel by pushing up levees, closing side streams. Logs and boulders were considered obstructions and removed. The river was considered safe and under control. Property was then once considered floodplain, owned by the river, was now considered buildable and highly desirable riverfront property. I bought my home to raise my family in a neighborhood thinking that it was safe and out of harm's way. Since then, I've seen a 100-year flood every 15 years. High water events close to the volume of a 100-year flood occur frequently and were never considered a regular event. The flood in 1996 was a neighborhood's first 100-year flood, where the Upper Sandy witnessed channel migration. Not understanding what the term meant and figured it would be another 100 years before we see or experience that much land loss, we thought we were safe. With a low elevation snowpack and a shift in weather to a Pineapple Express, which dropped over 9 inches of warm rain in 24 hours, in 2011, we experienced another 100-year flood event. I was standing on the riverbank watching the river wash away the ground that formed our neighborhood with the Homeowners Association president. We were sure the Army Corps of Engineers would show up, build a levee to protect us. Little did we know. After meeting with governing agencies, we soon learned we were on our own. Protection from the river was a homeowner's responsibility. We could get all the advice on required permits for riverbank protection and work with the Watershed Council to apply for grants. I taught myself how to design and permit riverbank stabilization projects and worked with an excavator to build revetments to protect my neighbor's properties. It was clear to me that lot-by-lot stabilization was not the most effective way to protect homes and neighborhoods. It has to be done reach by reach. The Sandy River Watershed Council organized neighborhoods along with governing agencies to analyze the Upper Sandy to identify what could be done. This project was called Restorative Flood Response. Dogami mapped the Upper Sandy along with natural systems design, identify and channel migration zones, along with prescribed treatments that would minimize damage and loss if projects could be undertaken. I continued to be involved with the river, became a board member of the Sandy River Watershed Council, became a Clackamas County Planning Commissioner, and became involved with the Oregon Solutions Channel Migration Policy Workshop. Local government has its hands tied from what it can see from what I can see within the County Planning Commission. Until we have state policies that require restrictions in these zones and give local government guidance on regulating development within the channel migration zones, we are set up for severe losses. Some sort of resettlement or managed retreat or land exchange should be available to existing homeowners and developers that already have invested money because of a change in policy. Nothing has happened in the last 8 years since 2011 to regulate development in these high hazard zones. My neighborhood is built on sediment deposits that are still moving downstream as part of a natural volcanic process. And with each high water event, more of my neighborhood ends up as part of the sediment deposits, changing the channel locations at the mouth of the Columbia. Development continues to go on as if nothing has been learned. Loss of life, property, infrastructure is going to happen without any change in our policies. Each of us know that danger exists. What will it be like if nothing is done and there's loss of life? Please consider what we are asking. Consideration of the channel migration zone risk has to change so local governments can protect the citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Okay. Any initial questions? Vice Chair McLean.
So the planning folks that were basically involved when the first decision on if homes could be built there was Clackamas County, or was it one of the little cities, or?
Or are you asking if his community is in unincorporated Clackamas County or if it's in Sandy?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative McLean, it was Clackamas County. We're in an unincorporated area, so it's governed by the county building codes.
Thank you.
Yeah. We are also neighboring an endangered species habitat, which also puts further restrictions on us. So there's very few things that you can put in the river. In fact, you can't put anything in the river, including water, unless you go through the proper steps. There's many agencies that protect our rivers. They're, as we know, an extreme value to the state of Oregon, and we want to keep them that way. And development is going to question that quality that we cherish so much. We're slowly bringing back the salmon populations, the steelhead populations. The Sandy River was reduced to 2% of its natural runs at one time, and we're slowly bringing that back, but it's showing promise. As long as we can keep moving in that direction and limit the amount of danger that we're allowing to happen by developing within these areas, we have to change this. And this is my goal. I've been working on it for 8 years out of my own pocket. I don't make any money doing this. This is all volunteer work, and it's a lot of work. But
thank you.
Anybody else at the moment? Okay. Great. Thank you. And we will ask Robert Houston from Dogami and Christina Appleby, also from Dogami, to come and join us. And then on deck after that, I believe, if I got this right, is Nancy Bush. Nope. Oh, Sadie and Matt. Where does Nancy, and then Nancy will come after that. Okay.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Houston. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Today we'll be providing a presentation as a snapshot on Dogami's channel migration mapping program without addressing the potential policy discussions here today. Because it's outside of my area of expertise, I've asked our subject matter expert to provide the testimony.
Chair Clem and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christina Appleby. I'm a geohazards analyst and supervisor at the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, also known as DOGAMI. It's my pleasure to speak to you today about channel migration and some of the science behind the work that we're doing at DOGAMI. To begin and set sort of the stage for the conversation we're having, channel migration is a natural process by which rivers move laterally across their floodplains through time. All rivers migrate, but some migrate more quickly than others, and some of those processes can be quite gradual. We usually see this and experience this through bank erosion and sediment deposition within a river system, and it is certainly related to flooding, but does not occur only when flooding happens. You know, erosion can happen and does happen on a day-to-day basis. So the local geology and hydrology are primary factors in determining a river's ability to move laterally. To put that in some context, for example, you could imagine a river flowing through bedrock in some sort of canyon-like channel will move laterally very slowly, as opposed to a major river like the Willamette River that you see in this image, flowing through a wide open floodplain, encountering loose gravels and sands and cobbles. That type of river would we would expect to have the energy and ability to migrate more quickly through time. And the image that you see on the screen here is a good example of some of the historical channel features that we see in the topography today. This is an image utilizing our high-resolution LiDAR topography. The blue and white is highlighting some of those old features, remnant scars, if you will, where the channel, the Willamette River, previously occupied a much wider area over time. Our LiDAR data is really good at helping us detect these types of patterns. It's important to recognize that we have a relationship with channel migration where we as humans have an impact on channel migration and channel migration has an impact on us. Rivers throughout the state can and have migrated rapidly, impacting buildings, roads, railroads, and other types of infrastructure. The example that you see here, not from Clackamas County, but in Tillamook, that is an example of damage to the port of Tillamook Bay Railroad along the Salmonberry River and damage to that Salmonberry River Bridge that occurred during the December 2007 windstorms that hit our coast. They eroded the bank and undercut the railroad, and you also see exposed fiber optic cable communications, trans-Pacific communications lines exposed in this case. Likewise, we do have an impact on channel migration. We have many stream management choices available to us, such as bank armoring, constructions of levees and dams, and changing stream bank vegetation, which affects the rate and ability of a stream to migrate with time. At DOGAMI, we're taking a couple of approaches to scope the issues around channel migration in Oregon. First, 2 years ago, we completed a statewide screening for the entire state's major rivers, which is roughly 7,000 miles of river are considered major rivers in populated areas that are well recognized. Within that, we were trying to identify areas of potential channel migration at a very high level so that we could prioritize future work and funding to examine, to identify those areas of higher potential susceptibility. We were classifying all of these 7,000 miles of stream into low, moderate, or high channel migration potential based on the broad physical properties of the river, its curvature and sinuosity, its location relative to bedrock versus a wide open floodplain, those types of very broad features. And so this screening was able to help us prioritize areas that needed more detailed mapping. And our study showed, for example, that just over 100 of Oregon's incorporated cities, which is just less than half of our incorporated cities, have a river running through them that was considered high potential for channel migration and would need closer examination in the future. So the second part of what we do at DOGAMI is to do detailed channel migration mapping. So in those areas of high potential, we want to do this type of work. In 2011, we produced our first channel migration zone maps in Clackamas, Coos, and Hood River County. These channel migration zone maps are, again, based on that high-resolution LiDAR data where we're able to identify areas the river previously occupied, and it's informed by the geology and other factors that we know about those locations to map out at a neighborhood or reach scale the potential corridor around the river in which the river might move in the future. That's the objective of the detailed mapping. We recently received federal funding to complete more detailed channel migration zone mapping in four counties in Oregon. That's Benton, Marion, Morrow, and Washington counties. And again, that's fully federally funded, same as the previous study. And those maps are expected to be published in the next year or two. And that's everything that I have prepared. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, you've stunned us.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're to Sadie Carney and Matt Kroll. Goodbye.
And what? You gotta do it, do it, do it. You go for that.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, I am Sadie Carney. I work for the Department of Land Conservation and Development as a policy analyst, and I have with me today Matt Kroll, who is our planning services manager and oversees the work of our natural hazards planning staff. So we have neither a beautiful nor a picturesque slideshow like Dagami, so I apologize in advance for that. The way that we can discuss channel migration zones as DLCD is within the framework of the National Flood Insurance Program. That's a federal program that we are the state coordinating agency for. And it is the closest nexus to channel migration zones in the work that we do, because channel migration zones is not an area that we participate at a state or any other level. Channel migration zones are specific to rivers, as you learned in Dagami's presentation, and they're not defined in the National Flood Insurance Program right now. But as I said before, the NFIP is our best frame for this discussion. So I was going to have Matt talk briefly about the NFIP and how it works from a property owner and local government level, because he is far and away the better expert to do so.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I am Matt Kroll on the staff of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I do want to just start from the small and we'll work our way up to get a little background on the National Flood Insurance Program and how it relates to some of this channel migration. So flood insurance is required for property owners if they are inside the special flood hazard area. We'll come up to that phrase a couple more times here. If they have a mortgage from a federally backed bank. So it's not everybody is required, but a lot do. You have an option to buy it from the national program, the National Flood Insurance Program, or there are some options for private insurance, and that's becoming more common right now. The rate that you pay, that annual premium, if you're getting it through the NFIP, has a lot to do with either in or outside the special flood hazard area. And it's important to remember you can buy flood insurance even if you are outside what's been mapped as the special flood hazard area. And most of it, though, right now is based on the elevation. But of course, we've been talking about the horizontal migration, but the vertical elevation is really what controls within the National Flood Insurance Program. Local governments have a role to play too, though. Although, as a property owner, you're buying that insurance from the federal government, you can only do that if your local government, your city or county, has participated in the NFIP. What does it mean to participate in the NFIP? A couple of things. One is that you're going to adopt those flood maps that FEMA produces, and you're going to put them in your zoning as a zoning overlay, and then you're going to adopt some development regulations. FEMA sets out what the minimum regulations are that you have to in order to participate, but communities do have the option to go to a higher level of standard, a stricter standard, and to be more restrictive about what is allowed and how to build in there. If you do, you can get points through the community rating system, CRS. The good thing about that is if you join the CRS as a county or city, the property owners start to get discounts on their flood insurance. One of the things that you can get points for in the CRS is to regulate on channel migration zones. So it is built in there a little bit. It's not directly, but it's in there.
I will say Marion County participates in the community rating system, as does the city of Salem. So the lowest score you can get is a 10, and I would assume the highest is a 1. I don't
it's
know.
It's the best, yeah.
Yeah, is the best. And both Marion County and Salem are at a 5 right now.
We have probably, I think, 20 or 30 communities throughout Oregon that do participate at different levels in that. Mm-hmm. And so here, just to say, all of our counties participate, so that's good news for Oregon residents. Almost all of our cities, there are a handful of cities that don't really have any flood hazard area. Believe it or not, in Oregon, there are a few. And some of our tribes participate, so most of the population's covered. We feel really good about that. There is also a state role. Although we talked about, as a property owner, you're buying this insurance from the local government or from the federal, and the local government has to participate. So where are we at the state? Well, one thing is we have a staff on a member at DLCD who is the statewide coordinator. Her name is Celinda Adair. She's not here today because she is off in Ontario working with them, helping out the city of Ontario on their. Our role is to advise local governments, and especially for some of the smaller communities, we tell them, when you have questions on this stuff, because you deal with it once every couple of years, just call us. We're dealing with it all the time. We have education outreach, try to make sure that insurance agents, surveyors, real estate agents, and just the general public, but those professions especially, have to know about this thing, the flood insurance. And then that community assistance visit, that's what's going on today out in Ontario. It's there to help them. But I'll be honest, it is also partly to check up on them. As the local governments, we have a role. The federal government has sent us out and said, you need to find out if the cities and counties are doing everything properly on this, mm-hmm. just to keep the program going along well.
I would just add that you heard about our participation or our DLCD's participation in the Oregon Solutions Project. So our NFIP coordinator was one of our technical assistance staff that was involved in that conversation with Clackamas County. So that would be an example of the kind of advisory and assistance role that we can play at a local government. It's fairly limited because it's one person, and we're talking about state coordination of a federal program in a state that's pretty sizable, but that's the nexus with the project we're talking about today.
So I did put together a graph here to try to understand the difference between that vertical element and the horizontal element with the National Flood Insurance Policy. And so you can see here, here's just a representation of a creek. You've got your low water, your high water. The base flood elevation, that's sometimes referred to as the 100-year flood, but as you heard previously, that's probably not a good phrase to use because it certainly can come back more often than once every 100 years. So we call it the 1% flood or the base flood elevation, and that is what defines the special flood hazard area within which you have that requirement to buy flood insurance and within which all of the local government regulations apply. So in this case, I just put in a couple example houses. Those two red buildings there would be subject to the local regulations and subject to the requirement. One of them is a little bit elevated there, so that helps with their rates because they are elevated up above the base flood elevation, but they are still considered within the special flood hazard area. I do also want to point out that water doesn't always follow the lines on the map that we make for it, and so there is actually flood risk outside the special flood hazard area. A lot of the flood maps will also show what is, again, sometimes called a 500-year flood. Don't like to use that term, so it's here marked here as the 0.2% or a 1 in 500 chance every year, but it certainly can happen more often than once every 500 years. So that next house up there has some flood risk. It is not required to buy flood insurance, but I certainly would advise any owner who has that house, you should. You'll get a better rate on it, and you would be covered if there's a flood. But then the question is, where's this channel migration zone? It's not clearly defined under federal law. We have some places where Dagami has helped create some good maps of it. But so I drew in a couple of other houses that you might think, gosh, those could be subject to some channel migration, especially when there's a high bluff like that on the right side. They're well above the base flood elevation. They're not going to be subject to any of the requirements, but they are still at some risk and would advise that they do buy flood insurance. If the house is damaged during a flood, even if it's from erosion that undercuts it, that in most cases can be a claim through the NFIP, so we should do that.
I have the wrong one here.
Goal 7 of our 19 state
land use planning goals is one that all of our local comprehensive plans at the county and city levels are subject to. There are some goals that apply only to the coast. Goal 15 is only to the Willamette River. But Goal 7 applies to everybody, and we ask that local governments plan for the hazards that they are subject to. For many of our local plans in Oregon, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, this requirement for sort of defining Goal 7 in their comprehensive plan is met through participation in the National Flood Insurance Program. That's written right into the goal language. And for some communities, that is the extent of the risk that they have planned for, is that participation. Goal 7 has a lot of other language in it, and it has hazards defined beyond just flood risk. I'll go to the next slide. Oh, whoops. Oh, yeah, you did. Sorry. And so you can see a list of some of them here. So floods, which we've talked a lot about. In 2015, the legislative session discussed landslides a lot after the big landslide in Oso, Washington. We have discussed tsunamis extensively as a risk to Oregon cities and counties. We're talking a lot more about wildfire risk in recent conversations. And so these are some of the risks and the hazards that are defined in the goal. But I will point out that we do allow local governments the authority to define additional hazards and plan for those in a way that would remove personal property and life to and risk to life or safety within their comprehensive plans. We certainly wouldn't prohibit that. And we have seen, for example, some coastal communities take steps beyond what is defined in statute or rule anywhere to adopt additional tsunami regulations, either at a county or a city level, to provide that additional layer of planning that would help them sort of create that vision for their future that we hope to see in a comprehensive plan. I think that's all I have to say. Matt, would you add anything?
Nothing else.
All right, we're happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Questions for this group?
Okay.
Thank you. Now, Nancy Bush from Clackamas County. The grand finale, Nancy. Take us home.
So, good afternoon, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, and Post, and members of the committee. And thank you for having me here today and for your time for this informational hearing. I am Nancy Bush. I'm the Director of Clackamas County Disaster Management. And I'm going to speak to you today a little bit about CMZs and kind of continue the conversation a little bit and give you some idea and go through some photos of showing you some of the things that have actually been happening on the Sandy River. This is a very important topic for Clackamas County. And I also want to thank Representative Drazen for her leadership in helping us to get to this point and acknowledge Representative Williams as well for her leadership on this issue. The bulk of the discussion today is within her district. So you've heard from Dogami, and you know they've talked a little bit maybe about some of the LIDAR and stuff. So you're going to actually see some LIDAR mapping here in my presentation. And we're going to look at some things along the Sandy River. So I'm going to talk a little bit of historical context. I promise not to make it too much. I do have an undergraduate degree in history, but I promise not to go too deep. Talk about, you know, the flood of 2011, as well as some of the hazards of the channel migration zone, and some hopes that we have from the Oregon Solutions Group that is coming together. So this is a map just to show you. In 1964, you know, we had the Great Flood of 64. There were 485 dwellings in the CMZ at that time. And as you look at this, you see the dots populating. By this time, we now have 1,400 homes in that particular area. In 1964, 155 of the homes were totally destroyed. There were several others that were damaged. And we just try to think about what if this did happen to us today, which I think this may have been considered one of the 500-year floods. But what if this did happen today? And a lot of the homes in 64 were actual, you know, like they were cabins. They weren't permanent residents like they are today. This is some 1964 slides that I have just quickly. And if you'll notice, and you've heard from some of our colleagues, that the water actually undercuts the homes, and you can see that here. Water does not get into the home. So technically, the home doesn't have water in it. In many ways, it looks like it's fine. There's just nothing under the foundation. This is an historical document that we actually found in our office one day by accident. You know, it's good to have people who keep things. And it talks about, you know, the result was an action on the valleys, and the lower slope was like glacier-like. The north bank of the Sandy, just upstream from Brightwood, showed no indication of buildings, vegetation, or topsoil where a group of 40 houses existed prior to the flood. There was absolutely nothing there. And again, there were 155 homes destroyed. Mr. Murphy talked about this a little bit. We're going to have some just a couple slides on what happened with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer. So after 1964, they did come in, and they were going to, quote unquote, fix the river and put it back in its place. So you know, there was a lot of heavy equipment out there. This is an aerial view of right after that happened. You know, they took out, as Mr. Murphy said, they took out boulders, they took out trees, and they put the river back where it was supposed to go. Very, very pretty, right? This is what it looked like in 5 years. Because the river wants to do what the river wants to do. And one of the things you're going to see is, you know, the river's coming up through this way, but it's wanting to cut through here. And you'll see that again in a more current slide that we're looking at in just a few moments. And all of this development back in here, you see that's all roads that were being developed, but the homes were not there yet. This is from 2011, and you'll see the river is going directly toward that home. This is after the water went down, and the picture was taken from the exact same place. And again, you have water that cut out underneath the home. You have a little sagging of the home right here. If you're in the front of the house, which I was before it was destroyed, you couldn't even tell. There was never any water in this home. And this is all from channel migration. This is one of the LIDAR mapping that we had done in Clackamas County. We used some federal funding to get some of this done. And you'll notice here that we have the river coming, the Sandy River, and it's taking out public infrastructure as well. This is really, really, really close to Barlow Trail Road. And it's also slingshotting over here for Lolo Pass. And I believe this was taken, this is a 2011 LIDAR. And in 2011, we lost 1,000 feet of Lolo Pass Road right through here. And we were lucky. Right up here is another stream. We were really lucky that this did not connect with that other stream, because we would not have been able to put the road back in place if that had happened. Just a little bit of, you know, Dogami mentioned, our colleagues from Dogami mentioned, you know, there's boulders, there's sand. You know, Mr. Murphy talked about that a little bit too with his home. So this is just a bank of sand. And when you have water that hits at a high velocity, it just washes it out. This is busy. I do apologize for that. But it's a really good picture of what happened in 2011. A couple things are going on here. I'm going to show you another slide in a moment. There was 111 feet of channel migration in this area. And you can see that in the next slide where it actually took that out. That's someone's property. In this case, it was the tennis courts at Timberline Rim. Those tennis courts are no longer used, but you can see where it just scoured into it. Also, there's some homes in this area right here. We had heavy rains just recently with some snow melt. We got a call from the fire chief. He called me and he's like, there's something going on up here. So one of my staff went up and with Mr. Murphy as well. And it was erosion. That's what was going on. It was erosion. They talked about sandbagging. Sandbagging does not work against erosion. So all you could do is sit there and watch it. The other thing I want to mention with this slide is this area right here. You'll see all of those lots. Those lots are literally in the river from the 96 flood. Again, channel migration. And I believe there were 5 homes lost during that time in this area, right there. Another busy slide. This is a Dogami slide. some of the LIDAR slides they were talking about in the hazard slide, which shows, you know, the river. And of course, we have avulsions in that area. And the yellow is the actively eroding area. And all of those little square boxes are homes or some kind of a structure. Most of them are homes. In this slide, which is also very busy, but you see the hatch mark in this purple area. It doesn't include all of the purple area, but that hatch mark there, that is the flood zone that my colleagues from DLCD was talking about in this area. And you look at the purple, that is a 100 feet buffer from that zone. And then we go out to this red, which is where we have identified a CMZ in that area. So if you'll notice, there's a lot of homes that are outside of that area for that's required for flood insurance if you have a mortgage. So it is a busy slide. And I will say here, too, that we recently did have that area remapped, FEMA did, for flooding. But there's been times that the river has actually been outside of the flood zone of the FEMA mapping. So that's very telling of this river. So I just want to finish up. Again, we are working with Oregon Solutions and the State Resilience Officer. And they have convened a work group to explore the issues. We do have the colleagues here in the room that are part of that group, as well as some other state agencies, to look at this and to see, you know, and they're working on a report right now, which is going to be out very soon, probably within the next couple of weeks, I think, because I think the draft is done. And we're hoping to see, you know, we're anxious to see or excited to see what those solutions might be, or at least what they are suggesting that maybe the state and the locals work together on in the future. Clackamas County encourages considerations for policy review and possible solutions to assist local governments with land use regulations and preventing additional development in an area that is prominently known for frequent flooding and for severe erosion. So thank you for having me today, and I'll answer any questions.
Are there any questions for our speaker? Thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation. Are there any other folks that wanted to speak on this issue? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on this issue, informational meeting, and we will go on to our last agenda item, which is abandoned and derelict vessels. And we have a whole group of folks that are coming to speak on this, so I'm going to open up the informational hearing and invite Malia and your crew up.
Thank you.
And if you would just introduce yourself in the order that you wish for the record, please. Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here this afternoon. My name is Malia Masiba. I am currently a senior policy and legislative analyst for the Oregon Department of State Lands, and I'm here with some colleagues who will introduce themselves in just a moment to talk with you about abandoned and derelict vessels, commonly referred to as ADVs. ADVs can look different and have different impacts depending on the specifics in which they show up. And while ADVs can present different challenges, the bottom line and what we're here to talk to you about today is that they are increasingly becoming an issue for the state. And as the number of incidents around ADVs increases, so do the costs, and not just financially. Oregon is seeing impacts from these vessels and the ancillary issues around them in our water quality, recreation access, as well as our public safety in some cases. One note, it was important for us to be able to appear in front of you today together because we agree that a joint agency approach to this issue is going to be important moving forward. ADVs impact each of our agencies a little differently, but at the end of the day, you'll see that they do impact a number of Oregon's agencies. In recent years, as ADV situations have become more common, our agencies have really seen the value of working together, and we believe that a continued coordinated agency approach is the best way forward. We are aware that there has work that's been done on this, and there is currently some work also in process and we don't want to reinvent the wheel. But what we're hoping to do is lean into that body of work, but with a collective perspective, and be able to bring back a proposal to you at some point that might begin to get at a framework for a statewide approach to respond to, or even in some cases, prevent these issues. So today, we're going to just take a few moments of your time and introduce you to this issue. Our vision is that today is a little bit of a stage setting exercise, and we hope to follow up with you as some of this work begins to wrap up and produce some specific recommendations. And in preparation of those future conversations, our program experts are here, and they're going to give you just a quick high-level introduction to abandoned and derelict vessels.
I'm Scott Smith with the Department of Environmental Quality. I work in the Emergency Response Section.
Chair Clem and members of the committee, I'm Patricia Fox, and I am the Proprietary Specialist of the Department of State Lands.
I'm James Kogel, Policy and Environmental Program Coordinator for the Oregon State Marine Board.
So, Chair Clem and members of the committee, this situation is not unique to the state of Oregon. In fact, this is a global issue. So what is an abandoned and derelict vessel? Oregon Revised Statute defines an abandoned vessel as a vessel that's left without authorization. More concerning is a derelict vessel, and this would be one that is actually either obstructing the waterway, creating a hazard, is already sunk or in imminent danger of sinking, or is already endangering life or property, or in such a dilapidated condition that we have some additional environmental concerns. This is a very complicated issue, and we could spend hours talking about it, but it really is multifaceted, and that's why it affects so many different parts of our state and all of us. There's a threat to navigation that would disrupt the public trust values in the state of Oregon. That would be commerce and business trying to go through the channel. We've also got people that can't recreate in the area, and it poses a public risk to our safety values, as well as recreational fishing. We've got nuisance, which not only is it a nuisance, but it's also an equity issue, because you have folks that actually pay for their vessels to be properly moored, and then these other folks that don't pay. And so that's an equity issue. In addition, there's a social component with housing concerns, because sometimes these vessels are occupied by folks that may otherwise be homeless. The disposal and logistics can be very costly and actually quite difficult, especially when we talk about older vessels post-World War I, World War II, that are just so large in scope and may be structurally unstable that we can't actually remove them easily from the riverway. We've got a legal process, of course, because we've got pre- and post-seizure notices that may be necessary to post, and you're talking about private property. Mostly, these vessels, no matter what kind they are not insured. And even if they do have insurance, it's very difficult for the claim to actually be processed. No agency actually has this issue solely for themselves, and there's just a complete lack of funding for all of our agencies to deal with this. And while we all have our own authorities and jurisdiction, you'll see throughout this presentation, hopefully, just how difficult and complicated this issue is. What we have done, and one of the greatest successes, is in recent years, we have very good agency coordination that has expedited and given us some success. As you'll see on all of these emblems, this is just a part of how abandoned derelict vessels actually reach all of our different agencies in different ways. So the point of this slide is to show that no one agency has this issue. It really affects all of us.
So homelessness issues do not end at the shoreline.
Sir, we have one question here.
Okay, sorry.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Vice Chair McLean. Could you go back to that picture? It's not massively important. I'm just curious, that last one, where is that?
Chair Clement, members of the committee, this is in Columbia County, outside Global, Oregon. This is a recent cleanup that was conducted actually with the Coast Guard, DEQ, Marine Board, State Police, and the Department of State Lands at the forefront.
Okay, thanks.
Sir, please continue.
So homelessness issues do not end at the shoreline. Many boats are left in locations without authorization, are occupied by people who may otherwise be living in unsheltered situations. There are challenges associated with persuading a person to accept alternative housing and services when they have shelter on the water. Abandoned derelict vessels are not confined to the water themselves, but can be found on land too. These are just two examples that the Department of Transportation has been dealing with, one under the bridge and one on the side of a highway. This chart shows the distribution by county of abandoned derelict boats that the Marine Board have assisted funding the removal and disposal of. While some areas have greater number of abandoned derelict vessels, they can be found in many areas around the state. This graph does not include boats that organizations like the sheriff's offices, public bodies, or private entities address themselves at their own cost. Abandoned derelict vessels can be found in a variety of locations, but also in have a variety of characteristics. These are not your historic wrecks. Instead, the average abandoned and derelict recreational boat is 25 feet long, 45 years of age, and often with a fiberglass hull. The images show a few examples that were found aground, sunk, or adrift in a channel.
So people come to own commercial derelict vessels for different purposes. A lot of times they hope to start a future business, restore the vessel, or just purchase it for its scrap metal value. But as you can see from these pictures, when it comes time to conduct a cleanup, it's not as simple as just putting a trailer in the water and pulling a boat out. You need a lot more resources in order to do that. And so we come into contact with oils, asbestos, PCBs commonly with these vessels, and it greatly exaggerates the cost of cleanup and the complexity. So once vessels become derelict or abandoned, regular maintenance is not usually performed on them. They then become unstable and sink. Oil can be released and cleanups are expensive. In the top picture there, you can see red dye diesel. It's why the white vessel is pink. That vessel was just 61 feet in length, but had hundreds of gallons of diesel on board, which we had to perform a cleanup on. The bottom right is a lube oil release from another vessel. And additionally, bunker fuel sometimes needs to be heated in order to be extracted. So especially when it's sunk, it's extremely difficult to get it out of a vessel. And obviously, the need to employ divers makes it all the more dangerous and complicated in order to do a cleanup. So other than fuel, derelict vessels can have lead, copper, PCBs, asbestos, solid waste accumulation, household hazardous waste, poisons, and pesticides, and even illegal drug labs. Each type of pollutant I just mentioned requires a different cleanup method, including the types of personal protective equipment that we need for our workers, special equipment to remove and transport the hazardous waste, and an overall waste disposal plan. These factors complicate a cleanup, extend the total cost and timeline for the removal of a vessel, and put the public and natural environment at risk.
So while we know that this issue is extremely costly to the state of Oregon, it's actually quite hard to really calculate accurately how much it does. On average, we know that recreational ADVs, due to their size and lack of complexity, are going to be much less expensive to remove and dispose of than commercial vessels because of their complexity, age, and size. And once a boat sinks, regardless if it's in recreational ADV or commercial ADV, it's going to be much more costly due to that potential contamination release that may have already occurred, and just because of the crane and everything else that may be needed once a boat actually sinks. So you can see the different costs associated with our recreational here. So current funding, in 2003, House Bill 3628 created the Abandoned Boat Removal and Cleanup Subaccount for the Oregon State Marine Board so that they would allocate $150,000 per biennium to deal with this issue. Now, these source of funds is the registration and titling fees on recreational boats, titling fees on floating homes and boathouses. So to date, most of the cleanup efforts have been on recreational boats only because that's really where the source of the funds is coming from, instead of commercial vessels where there really is no funding, period. The Department of State Lands has been allocating about $35,000 per biennium. Now, none of these costs include the staff time, the DOJ attorney fees for the pre and post seizures and all the personal property that's involved, the resources, sheriff costs, and so forth. While the Oregon State Marine Board and the Department of State Lands, of course, try to recover any costs that they expend from the responsible party, frankly, oftentimes there are no assets to actually go after and collect. So the key to this really is prevention and awareness. One, because we don't want new vessels that are in a poor state of repair to be entering the waterway. And two, because the current list of already prioritized vessels are going to continue to age and weather as time goes on while they stay on the waterway. So really, we need to get these vessels off the water and prevent new ones from coming onto it. The good news is that we have been coordinating so well, as well as with the ports and marina owners, so that they can put new vessels on our radar that we should be concerned about before they sink. But we really need to get more public involved and to really gather more support for this issue. because we have a lot of work that's already been done. It just, we need to continue the work. So in 2011, the Derelict Vessel Task Force was really the first big effort between the state of Idaho, Washington, and Oregon to come together to really talk about the list of vessels that are crossing state boundaries, because as one state would increase their enforcement, then of course, if the boat was mobile, they would just cross over into another waterway, into a new state. So that was a good effort of actually starting to track and do an inventory on these vessels. Then we've got the Transient Boater Work Group. This is a fairly new group from 2016. It's focused primarily and really only in the Portland metro area. And that also is because it lends itself to a social issue of homelessness. So they're really working on a vessel turn-in program and really on alternative housing. You've got the Derelict and Abandoned Commercial Vessel Task Force. This was with the Oregon State Marine Board and with the Ocean Sea Grant and Oregon Sea Grant from 2016. And this was unique because it wasn't just agencies talking to each other, but really involving the ports and the marinas and looking at commercial vessels only, because we really have no source of funding for those. Finally, you have the Pacific States British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force just from last year. I'm happy to report that the three of us actually representing our agencies are all on this. And our focus is to have a blue ribbon model program of how the state can proactively and progressively attack this issue. And this is for a myriad of different states all the way down to Hawaii, because we know that we're not the only ones facing this, and we really are trying to do a comprehensive approach. We want to let you know today that this issue is not going away. If we don't do something about it, it's just going to get worse. And frankly, just to know that this issue does not belong to just one agency. The good news is that we are very coordinated, and hopefully we will be back looking for funding and possibly some legislative direction as we move forward with our Blue Ribbon program. And the work from that hopefully will be complete by summer of 2020. So we are on a fast track. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Are there any questions for our speakers? Seeing no questions, I will close the informational hearing on, I don't know the new abbreviation, but Abandoned Derelict Vessels. So thank you very much for being here today, and we look forward to more information and an update. Are there any other issues from the committee or from staff? Then we will close the meeting for today, and we are adjourned.